allegations that there had been cover-up in Raphoe and Derry when he had been bishop in both parish, in both dioceses.
Another major issue that you will have covered over the years is the issue of the mother and baby homes, and in particular the Magdalen laundries. And from your point of view, you had a very unique family reason to take an interest in that.
Yeah, I mean, my aunt had to emigrate to London in the early 1950s with her then fiancé because she got pregnant. I mean, that was a huge, potentially huge scandal in rural Ireland at that time, the very traditional part of rural Ireland I came from. In London, he abandoned her and went off to America where he had a family of his own. He abandoned her there, and she was working at W.H. Smith's in Oxford Street, and one of the other staff there was very, very moved by her plight, and my aunt Mary was breaking down, etc., and she confided in this woman what the situation was. And this woman who lived in South London had a basement flat in her rather large house. She created an apartment for Mary there, where Mary lived for the rest of her life, most of the rest of her life, and reared her son, my cousin. And I stayed with them as a student when I was in London. I mean, the revelation of Mary's story came very late in my life. I mean, as in my teens where I found out about it, because it was such a scandal that nobody talked about it at home. I wasn't aware till quite late, if you like, in terms of how long I was living at home. And she then, in the late 90s, came home to Ireland and lived with the rest of the family for her latter days and died in 2000, and her son is in Canada, my first cousin.
And she could so easily ended up in one of those mother and baby homes, and that story could have been very, very different.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the case, Donald. I shudder to think about it, because in the early 1950s, in my part of Ireland, girls who became pregnant out of marriage were usually shuffled off to the mother and baby home in Tuam, which has become notorious for the fact that they found the remains of nearly 800 babies there in the grounds of that institution, which is investigated by the Mother and Baby Home Commission, and which currently scientists are investigating, trying to identify the remains by DNA evidence, which is going to be a hell of a task, but anyhow, they're doing so.
You covered so much as religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times, and I mean, we haven't even touched on things like Drumcree, which you also would have taken an interest in, not to mention the election of popes and the time you would have spent in Rome as well. Time has beaten us. Patsy McGarry, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you, and the book is a fascinating read. Well, Holy God, My Life as an Irish Catholic Agnostic Correspondent, Patsy McGarry. It's a wonderful book, it's a wonderful read, and Patsy, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. It's our 3 of the 9 till noon show, slightly late, 8 minutes past 11, with apologies to our next guest. And any regular listeners to the show don't have to wonder who the next guest is, because after the 11 o'clock headlines on a Monday, we always say the same 4 words. Good morning, Brendan Devaney.
Don't you worry, I'll always wait for you, my man.
No, do you know what, you're a gent. Brendan, an interesting weekend of championship action, and a few big games taking place over the course of the weekend, and I suppose, first of all, it has to be said, sticking just down the road, a win for St. Eunan's over Naomh Connell, they'll welcome that win.
Yeah, listen, any victory, championship's great, and I suppose teams away from home, and if you look at it, you know, people would certainly put St. Eunan's and Naomh Connell kind of up there, you know, Kilcare, maybe just behind them, Gidor, kind of in that kind of... That's how it's been the last number of years, and it's been a real ding-dong. Certainly Naomh Connell are back-to-back champions. And so listen, you know, when these teams are playing each other, of course you always want a victory, but this is just a group. So listen, the ultimate games are down the line, but, you know, certainly in Donegal, if you want to do anything, you know, Naomh Connell are the standard bearers. You know, as I say, they're the champs back-to-back. They've done really well in Ulster. Came so close last year to beating Glenn Mahara, the eventual All-Ireland winners, you know, just a point in it. And a lot of what might have been. So certainly Naomh Connell have been really flown the flag well in Ulster when they went in there too. So listen, between them and Eunan's, a lot of people, I think, in the county are saying that they're a small step ahead. Not much in the game, Donal, and because it was a group game, you know, I think both teams were missing a few players as well. So I think very much it's a way championship is now. Great crowd in it now, Donal, in fairness, compared to Eunan's game with Kilcare last week, you know. Well done to everybody involved in Naomh Connell there. You know, it's a big operation, don't lose. The cars were coming out of there for so long after the match. Such was the interest. And I think there's a lot of neutral interest. Again, going back to what we're saying, don't, a lot of people want to see these two teams play a lot in that. And just while it's not cut and throat championship, you're always kind of known, you know, when you don't have jeopardy in championship, it's always played out a certain way. And I suppose Shane O'Donnell's goal in the second half was the big score in the game. So listen, should you be happy that, but I don't think it'll bother Niamh Connell that much at all. You know, they'll still obviously be in the mix come the finish of it, Donal, and that's what they want. They'll be getting ready for championship. You know, it's two from Glenn Swilly as well.
Mm-hmm. And Clahanilly gave them a game.
Yeah, and you know, suppose Clahanilly, bit of bite back, a couple of goals kept them in it there, Donald. But yeah, Glenn Swilly getting a new team together, no more than four masters that are top in the group. You know, they've had to go back. Glenn Swilly, of course, had that brilliant team that won three championships, and you know, there's still a few of them still playing in there. You know, particularly Exit Copper and Michael Murphy, and these guys trying to bring through the next regime of players, and for four masters as well. Been a brilliant start to the season for them, you know, backing up their first day victory, a huge victory over the Gidor to go away to Downing's then and play really well. A hat-trick from Sen and Kerr, you know, Shane Kerr's lad. So they're going really well. I suppose McCool's as well, going away from home. And, you know, you talk about away from home victories, you know, going down to Killy Beggs and a victory for him. Of course, they were in the semi-final last year. So you're looking at a few teams like that, Donal, looking to push on. You know, you're looking now. Our four masters starting to come into a mix where they could get into a semi-final, maybe, you know, go to that kind of berth. Glenn Swilly will be looking to aim the same. McCool's were in it last year. They'll be looking to go a step further, go to the final. Of course, then you've got Gidor and Kilcar. And as I say, you know, you'd have the two championship favourites, as it has been this last number of years, St Junans and Leif Connell.
A lot of discussion, obviously, on the DL debate tonight, looking back over the weekend action from Donegal and indeed further afield. As ever, an action-packed programme with three erudite and knowledgeable guests to discuss the games with you.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, great to have them on. Two Park Hilford will be up in studio with us. We have in John Gilday as well. He would have been at the match yesterday in his hometown club. And we have Oney McGarvey as well. Oney's a coach there from Annagry. He's got great experience in the game and does a bit of commentary as well for Radio McGeltica. So great to have Oney on too. And I suppose we'll look across all the championships, you know, intermediate, junior and ladies. And Marion O'Donnell's actually coming on next week to do a special LGFA championship overlook, see where the championship's up, how teams are going on that, Donal. Because sometimes I'm very aware, you know, if you try and cram everything in, the time is so short when you go on to discussion and games again. Because there's so many championship games, you may pick out a week at different times and concentrate on the likes of the ladies, or really concentrate on more in depth into the likes of junior or intermediate at different times, depending on what's happening in the championships, Donal. So that's why Maureen's coming on next week to do a more in-depth look at the ladies.
Another really important guest tonight, obviously, is the man who saw his team go all the way this year, Geezer.
The Geezer's on, yeah. Do you know what's interesting, Donal? I was uncovering the Derry and Armagh game after we had beaten them in Ulster, and again, all the rhetoric with Armagh, can't win a tight game, you know, lost on penalties, again. You know, it was just, there was so much weight bearing on them. And, you know, I had a great chat to Kieran McGinney. I was undoing it for News Talk, and I had a great chat with Kieran McGinney after the game. You know, I would know him very well. Obviously, he played Ulster and was on tour in Ireland with him. And, you know, even though we had a, you know, they were certainly the arch nemesis in my time, you know, as time goes on then, you know, you get to know lads more for the men or the people that they are. And, you know, me and Geezer would get on well. And, you know, his 10 years there, you know, the story of it is just amazing in terms of the knockbacks. Of course, the vote of confidence, if you like, last year, it was put to the board. That was just last season, you know, and people think he could have went out. He could have been out of the Armagh job. And you think of the different things that have fallen into place. And listen, Armagh wanted an Ulster, don't they? They didn't want an Ulster, but that certainly wasn't their aim. They wanted Ulster by hook or by crook. We stopped them doing that. We won it. But then ultimately they won the All-Ireland. So an unbelievable story. So looking forward to catching up with him and seeing what he made of the season, what his plans are going on the next year as defending champions. I mean, it's an amazing story.
And it's fair to say that Kieran McGinney didn't pull any punches on the pitch, and I'm sure he doesn't pull any punches in the conversation either.
Yeah, well, I don't know if palm punches are thrown them, but there was a bit of something going on, though. But as a good hurling man from Waterford knows, you know, Ulster and Munster hurling, they are the outliers in our All-Ireland Championships now. And listen, Armagh were almost unbeatable there in Ulster at a stage. You know, they had such a record, particularly Clonus. Unfortunately, to the hurt of us Donegal boys at the time. But yeah, listen, he was a serious player and leader himself. And I think because of that, Donal, if you look back to that vote, because of his stature as a player, mm-hmm. it was enough to carry him through some of them barren years where, let's not forget, Donal, he couldn't even win a game in Ulster. I think there was maybe, I think in six seasons there, they won one game in Ulster from a team that kept winning in Ulster in his time. I mean, the record was absolutely shocking, and there was a lot of people calling for him to go. He kept building, and then they just went on this run this year. So yeah, it's an amazing story. Some people, you know, might question it versus, you know, Ulster and games lost and different things around the championship and that. But there's two types of our championship now, very much, you know, in terms of you have your provincials and then you're into an All-Ireland series. And listen, anything can happen in that run, you know, topping your group, you know, the way Armagh did. Obviously, the way they went through the games for Roscommon, I think, very much suited them in that quarter. And then, you know, they got that bit of confidence in Croke Park. And then there's this against Kerry, I suppose, you know, Kerry could have been out of sight. Missed a couple of goals. So I think in any game, in any championship run, there's times in there where you've got to have the luck of the bounce. And maybe Armagh didn't have that for years. Maybe they deserved it against Kerry and then deservedly beat Galway in the final.
Well, it's tenaciousness personified, I suppose, 10 years and finally got there. DL debate on tonight, 7 o'clock, after the 7 o'clock news, in association with Sarah's Kitchen, our sister Sarah's in Letterkenny, Brendan Deveney and his panel, and Kieran McGeaney as well. Tonight, after the 7 o'clock news, Brendan, I'm sure you're going to have a huge listenership for that tonight, and all the best. Brendan, take care. We were chatting to Patsy McGarry before the news at 11. Caller says, the Bible says there is nothing hidden or covered up that shall not be revealed and made known. And that's the job of people like Patsy McGarry. Another caller says, the cover-up of the Catholic Church is horrendous, but why does no one talk about the cover-up in homes where children were abused by their fathers, brothers, uncles, etc.? A lot of those girls that were sent to homes were pregnant by their own relatives, but nobody talks about it. Caller says, huge scandal in rural Ireland, so what did their parents do? The caller says, why child abuse in Catholic Church? Worst child abuse is by fathers and mothers, but never mentioned. Talk about child abuse in sport. Please make it fair. We had hoped for people who joined the priesthood to hide their perversion, which is so unfair to our good priests. But please talk about all other child abuse as well. The caller says, please stop talking about Northern Ireland as it only has six counties. Also, my friends who live in the six counties of Northern Ireland do not under any circumstances call themselves British. They are Irish. We could use the new Finn Harp Stadium in Stranraer for the Olympics. It could be up and running by 2072. A caller with tongue firmly in cheek there. Caller says, first of all, stop funding the horse racing and dog racing worlds. Channel all that sport into schools. And the caller asking, could you ask Donal who won the busking this year? I can tell you it was an act from Derry called Tessio. Two young lads, a duet, playing guitar, close harmony singing, absolutely brilliant singers. My only regret is that because I was taking part with my own gang of mates in the ukulele orchestra, I was not able to listen to Tessio's whole set, but I was chatting to him at the presentation afterwards and heard what they played there, and they were absolutely superb, and congratulations to them. Now, we are going to change tack because Sinn Féin has launched its new mental health action plan, which it says will transform the delivery of mental health services across the state if implemented. Joined by Deputy Mark Ward, who is Sinn Féin's spokesperson on mental health. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Donal, and thanks for having me on the show this morning.
It's our pleasure, and thank you for joining us. We've spoken to your party colleagues, Piers Doherty and Padraig McLaughlin, on numerous occasions about issues, not least with CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, and also the provision of acute services for adults and emergency services as well. These are all issues that you're seeking to address and put answers into place. As the Sinn Féin spokesperson on mental health, do you believe you have found a formula that will work?
Absolutely, Donal. Like this is a culmination of 4 years' work. This since I was named the party spokesperson for mental health, I've engaged with stakeholders right across the state, from the HSE to the community and voluntary sector, for even international expertise, Lakes of Oregon, who are experts in Australia in child and youth mental health. And I've also met with people who would have their first-hand lived experiences in relation to trying to get the right care in the right place at the right time for their own mental health. And this is a culmination of all the last 4 years' work, this document.
In terms of implementation, are you satisfied that a Sinn Féin-led government will be able to implement this in full? Are the resources there? in terms of money, first of all, but even more importantly, are the resources there or available in terms of staff? Because we know one of the issues that they've been having, particularly in Donegal in the northwest at the moment, in services is staffing, and that can be doubly difficult when it comes into areas like mental health and disability.
Yeah, so there's two questions there. Just in relation to the funding, we go through a very similar process than the government would go through. So I would meet with stakeholders. I would identify what I feel is needed. I would have went to the Department of Finance and Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, and I would have got the costings back from both of these departments. I would have presented them to the party, and you mentioned Pierce Doherty, who was our spokesperson on finance, and Pierce would have seen would this package fit in our overall alternative budget, and it does to the tune of 250 million over 5 years. So we're given the commitment that the money is there, and we're 100% sure that we will be able to deliver this. In relation to staffing, which is a really, really important question, and it comes up very, very regular. One of the things that we're not doing at the moment in this country is we haven't got a proper workforce planning in place in relation to how many trainee places are at third level education for the healthcare sector. If we haven't got enough people training, we're never going to be employ enough people. So we have a plan in place that's going to double the amount of places at third level education for people that are looking to work in the healthcare, not just mental health, but across the board. And year one, we would increase it by 20%. But we also have to put in place things that are going to help retain people that are currently in the post now. And that's making the workforces more kind of environmentally friendly to work in. And sometimes that is that when you increase staff, that makes it takes burdens off people and allows people then to be able to actually do the jobs that they want to do when they're in there.
You're highlighting local services like Jigsaw and indeed the services provided through GPs. And one of your arguments is that if you can get good local services right at community level, you're halfway there. Do you believe you will have the capacity to put those in place and we'll see groups like Jigsaw, who do hugely important work, be able to expand their roles and develop into more and more areas?
Early intervention is key, Donald, when it comes to people's mental health. And if you can get somebody the care they need at a primary level, like at Jigsaw, even at the likes at the GP, where we have a measure in place where GP can refer somebody into council, and we have free universal council for anybody that needs it as part of this package. If you get that kind of primary care piece right, then people are less likely to need the more acute services in relation to psychiatric facilities or the likes of CAMHS as they go on. So absolutely, if we can get the people the right care, the right place, the right time, at the earliest possible time, that will make a big, big difference to how we deal with mental health.
What will you be doing that the current government isn't doing? Because the government will argue it's putting more money than ever before into mental health. The government will argue it's implementing its own strategies. It's coming up with its own ideas. It's coming up with its own action plans. What are you looking to do differently to what's being done by Stephen Donnelly and his teams?
So, for example, and this is sometimes the solutions aren't rocket science. Like, so, for example, I mentioned for 250 million over a lifetime of this government is what we're going to commit. This is multi-annual funding. This will give community and voluntary organisations, with statutory organisations, a surety of exactly how much they have over a 5-year period. Every budget that comes up, we get lobbied left, right and centre. I know myself, particularly in mental health, where even the government, HSE, organisations are contacting us and saying they don't know how much money they're going to get this year. Because of that, they're unable to strategic plan, they're unable to forward plan, they're unable to meet the needs that may be coming down the line because they're only dealing with the here and now. So one of the very first things that we would do, we would introduce a multi-annual funding plan, which would make a huge difference. And I've worked in frontline addiction and mental health services, and I managed them, and I would have spent half my year chasing next year's money instead of delivering the service that needs to happen to the people that are accessing our service.
In terms of CAMHS, you would be looking to replace it with a new child and youth mental health service. And one of the important things is you want to see the age limit for that raised from 18 to 25, because we've heard this story so often here, and I'm sure you hear it in your own area as well, that young people are on waiting lists right up to the age of 18, just when they're about to get an appointment, just when something's about to happen, boom, they turn 18, bang, sorry, you're not our problem anymore. They're shunted out into the adult service and they go back to a queue and they start waiting again. You want to see it raised from 18 to 25. You believe that's going to make a big difference?
Absolutely, and as I said, this is part of the engagement that we had with experts right across the state and outside as well. Most people experience their first traumatic episode of mental health by the age of 25. So that 75% of all people will experience their very first one by the age of 25. At the moment, we do not have a service that will meet the needs of someone between the ages of 18 and 25. So this is what we're looking to do on this. This is not reinventing the wheel. This is international best practice that child and youth mental health services will extend to people at the age of 25. This will stop people falling off the cliff edge at the age of 18 and will also ensure that continuity of care for that young person. Just because somebody turns 18 doesn't mean that they actually turn into an adult. So, for example, my daughter next year, she'll be 18, she'll be still doing her leaving cert. That's a really tough time for people as well. So we have to make sure we have that continuity of care for people at the age of 18 up to 25.
One of the legacies, if that's the word, of COVID has been a lot of residential centres, day centres in mental health and also in provision of services for older people, provision of services for people with other disabilities and issues, have not necessarily reopened because space had to be reconfigured, there were issues with staffing, etc. And we have this legacy from COVID still of places that haven't fully reopened. You believe there's a number of such facilities in the addiction and mental health area that do need to be reopened, and you want to prioritise that?
Yeah, so one of the areas that we have, that this has happened right across, where facilities have closed and they haven't reopened, and there's been a lack of urgency from government to do so. One, for example, in Dublin, we have a facility called Keltoy, which is a unique service, which would have been an inpatient residential place for people with dual diagnosis of mental health and addiction issues. So, for example, if somebody went through the process of detoxing from whatever substance they were on, they would go into Keltoy then, and then they would rehabilitate. And that would give them the skills, new coping mechanisms, so they could go back out into the world and make a positive contribution. That piece has been missing since the last 4 years. So we have given the commitment that we would reopen Keltoy. Government have said they're going to reopen. Every time I raise it up, yeah, it's going to open back up, Mark, but it hasn't happened. We have a commitment that we will reopen this as soon as possible. The staff are there. So this is the thing. The staff are there, ready to go. They've been redeployed, and they're willing to go back in and open that service.
W. Mark Ward, the Sinn Féin spokesperson on mental health. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. We'll wait for the next general election. Are you preparing for November one?
We're preparing for one tomorrow. We've been preparing for the last while. We went to a selection convention ourselves over the last Wednesday, myself and Ona Brin in this area. So, yeah, we're ready to go. So the sooner the better.
And whatever happens after that next election, if the incoming government afterwards, be it November, be it March, be it whenever, if the incoming government is a Sinn Féin-led government, then can we expect to see work begin immediately on implementing this action plan?
So all we've been doing for the last 4 years, whether it's mental health, whether it's addiction, whether it's health, whether it's housing, have been getting things in place so we hit the ground running. We have left no stone unturned. If we get the opportunity to be in government next time, we will hit that ground running and be ready to go.
W. Mark Ward, thank you very much indeed. The 9 to noon show on Highland Radio. It's 26 and a half minutes to 12 midday, and it's time for our Monday Focus. And on the Monday Focus today, we are looking at the return of the Irish National Sheepdog Trials to Clonmany. The last time the national trials were held in Clonmany was way back in 1979, the year I was doing me intercert, and that's not today or yesterday. And delighted to say we're joined online by James P. McGee, who is the chair of the Donegal Committee of the International Sheepdog Society. James, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to speak to you, James. James, you are a former world and supreme champion with your dog, Glen Greg Silver. How important is it to you as a competitor and as a member of the Donegal Committee that the Nationals are coming back to Northern Ireland?
It's a great privilege to be involved in running this event, definitely. It's nice to bring it back to the area, I suppose, when I was just a nipper, if you like, running around, I think it's 79. Mm-hmm. So it takes quite a bit of effort to make these events happen, but we're privileged that a lot of people have come on board to make this happen.
The top Irish 150 dogs and their handlers are coming to Clonmany, and then Irish team for the international in September will be selected out of this. So this is a very important competition. There's a lot at stake here.
Definitely is, yeah. The top 15 competitors over the 3 days go forward to represent Ireland at international level, which is held in Scotland the second weekend in September coming now. So, like, I suppose in the sheepdog calendar, your national and the international is the highlight of the year. That's what you kind of work towards all year. So for anyone involved in sheepdogs and trialing and that, like, this is the pinnacle now coming up this week.
Will you be too busy on the organising side of things to be able to compete this year?
No, we're going to try and multitask. We're running two dogs. I'm on the Thursday and on the Friday. So fingers and toes and everything else crossed with.
Well, that is the very definition of multitasking, taking part in a competition that you're centrally involved in running. It's a very important competition, but you're doing all this on a voluntary basis, James. You have other interests, you have other work to do, but this is completely voluntary, and the organising committee is completely voluntary.
Yeah, that's correct. I suppose it's like most, a low movie sheepdog trial is not essentially a sport. But like most sporting bodies and that, it's nearly all volunteers that make it happen and that. And we're lucky to have an excellent committee on board that has given up their time to put the effort in to get this over the line.
And the competition is taking place, it's this week from August 22nd to August 24th, if I'm correct. That's Wednesday to Friday, isn't it?
Wednesday to Saturday. Sorry, Friday.
The 24th is Saturday. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
It is Saturday.
It's a Thursday to Saturday. Yeah. Sorry, I was getting my dates mixed up in my head there. In
it
terms,
starts 7:30 in the morning each morning, I think.
I mean, and I presume in terms of the organisation, a huge amount of work's gone into to getting Clonmany and getting the site ready for this.
Yeah, we're very lucky with the local landowners. Sean and Mary Doherty have been very welcoming to us, giving us their land to run this event, which is, it's a big deal for anyone to give up their property for the 3 days and invite people from basically all over Ireland, the 32 counties, plus, like, people coming from abroad to spectate on that as well. Like, so it is a big deal, and we're very lucky to have those landowners such as them that come on board with us. Without the landowners, we can't run these events.
And I was going to ask you that question about spectating. I mean, do you get many spectators coming? Because a lot of people, I'm sure, obviously will have an interest in it, being farmers themselves and having sheepdogs themselves and using sheepdogs in their own daily work. But as well as that, I mean, I certainly remember One Man and His Dog, that TV programme that was on BBC Two for absolute decades. And there was a lot of fascination about sheepdog trials and the, the relationship between the sheepdog and his owner stroke or her owner stroke handler. And I think a lot of it came totally down to people having seen that programme on BBC.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. Like, that's probably what has me hooked this last 20 years or so on sheepdog trial. Growing up, I would have watched it religiously on a Sunday evening. And then, like, even as a young boy, maybe 10 or 12, going out and trying to mimic what I'd seen on the TV, I must admit very badly, but, like, it's always something that was in my head. But getting on into the spectators and that, like, as opposed to football or that, like, it wouldn't have the same following as the footballer that would get. But there is a lot of people that are quite interested in, following the dogs. And, like, even people that you wouldn't think, that maybe doesn't have a farming background or that. But, they just find it fascinating to kind of, watch the dog working the sheep and, the communication between the handler and the dog. You know, a lot of people would call it maybe majestical, just to see that relationship that the handler and the dog has, and the communication that's there.
And presumably a lot of the audience too that are spectating are going to be very knowledgeable about it and will understand what's going on, perhaps more so than people that are going to just watch a sporting event for the sense of occasion. I'm sure you have a very committed audience, and I'm sure a lot of spectators will be coming that you know, go every year, and you'll be going out to compete, and you'll be looking at the spectators, and you'll probably recognise at least half of them and be on first name terms with most.
That'll be right, yeah, that's correct. You do quite often, when there's a sheepdog trial running, you will find, though, like, you may have tourists and something like that, you know, where they kind of catches their eye driving past, they pull up and come in, but no, you're right, like, the vast majority of people would have an understanding of what's happening.
You said earlier, and I want to pull you up on this, because you said earlier you were imitating one man and his dog, with no great effect or with no great skill. The fact that you went on to become a world and supreme champion would suggest you developed that skill along the way. In terms of the relationship between you and your dog, in terms of the whistles and the spoken commands and the gestures, I mean, to an outsider looking in, it seems very esoteric and very strange. I presume those gestures, those whistles, those words, those commands are developed over years, and there's a symbiotic relationship between yourself and the dog that it takes an awful long time to actually develop and get right.
Yes and no, maybe to your question there. It takes maybe a period of time to get the commands and that clear in your mind, you know, as a handler. It's crucial that you have to have it correct in your mind before you try and put it into the dog's mind. But to actually train a dog, it's amazing how intelligent the Border Collie is. It's generally all Border Collies that are sheepdogs. Not exclusively, but broad spectrum is generally the Border Collie. But they're a very, very intelligent dog. And probably you would have the basics taught to a dog, say, I would, not everyone would agree, but I would say maybe a 4 to 5 month period, something like that, with a young dog starting out, say, maybe around a year old, providing the dog is very interested, if you like.
Are the commands the same? I mean, if are the commands the same, or does each individual have their own different commands? In other words, if you were to take a different dog, a dog that had been trained by somebody else, could you go out with a dog you didn't know and a dog that didn't know you and successfully compete? Or does a relationship have to build up between the handler and their specific dog?
Generally, the will in the dog is to work, and with most dogs, it doesn't matter, you know, after a period of maybe a few days or a week or 2 weeks, the dog will kind of take to the person. But probably broad spectrum, the commands, like the left command on a dog is come by, the right command is either away or away to me. You have walk on or walk up, which means get up and bring the sheep type of thing. Then just basically lie down or stand, and they are as suggested. And then, like, most handlers will introduce their own set of whistles to that, to, you know, so for, like, a left command will have a certain tone, the right command will have a certain tone and pitch to it, and the same with the other commands, the walk on, the get up, the stand, that type of thing. And probably the last thing that is taught to a dog would be the kind of the look back command. So that's where they kind of fetch one group of sheep, and then you maybe stop the dog and turn it around and send it back for another group. So that would be kind of the very end of the training, basically.
But the difference between someone who can competently handle a sheepdog on a day-to-day job on a farm versus the level of communication it's going to take to win a national or an international championship is going to be huge. So maybe anyone can interchange with another dog on the day-to-day work, but in order to win a national championship or an international championship, or even, as you've done, become world and supreme champion, that's going to take something special between yourself and the dog, and that's not going to be picked up in 4 or 5 months.
No, definitely not. There has to be a special bond with your dog, in my opinion, to, you know, to get to that level of success. You know, it's a partnership. You know, you're doing it together. It's not something you can kind of bully the dog into doing, if you like. You know, the dog has to want to work for you. It's kind of like people going to work, you know, you'll get the most out of people, you know, if you're nice and respectful towards them, rather than the opposite. So it's definitely very important that you have a good relationship and with your dog.
James P. McGee, Chair of the Donegal Committee of the International Sheepdog Society, part of the organising committee and indeed a competitor in the National Sheepdog Trials, which take part on Thursday, Friday and Saturday in Clonmany. Thanks indeed for speaking to us. We wish you all the best. We wish all the competitors all the best. And may you have success and may you be Scotland bound in September.
Thank you very much for having us on. And can I just have a final word and thank, I'm not going to start naming anyone because I'm sure to forget someone, but I would like to thank everyone who has got behind this national, either through sponsorship or given the field, our committee, you know, everyone that has input into making this happen. It is very much appreciated. So thank you, one and all.
James P. McGee, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Let's look at a few of your comments before we go to our next guest. Caller says, I was in Derry with two kids on Saturday. They had to go to the toilet. There were no toilets available. There was a chapel next door, but there were no toilets open there. We had to use the toilet in a pub, and there should be more toilets available in this day and age. We spoke earlier about mobile phones and the online experience of children. Caller says mobile providers should be responsible for keeping children safe online. They're more interested in making commission than doing the right thing. Mobiles shouldn't be sold to children. We need laws to ban mobiles for children. They should be fined if they don't oblige. I bought a game online recently. I had to prove who I was. They wanted my ID and a picture of my bank card to prove it was me. Caller says, I went to the summer sessions in Letterkenny on Saturday. Show was fantastic, but the prices they were charging for food was unreal. $18.50 for a burger and chip and drink. They hadn't their prices advertised, so no way of knowing until you ordered. Such a rip-off. What Ireland is becoming, it shows. I can tell you, caller, that as long as I've been going to gigs and festivals, and that's a fairly long time, beer in particular and food and drink minerals have always been overpriced at festivals. I'm afraid I can confirm that very much is the case. Now, moving on, there's been a lot of discussion about restaurants and the number of restaurants which are closing down. Adrian Cummins is Chief Executive of the Restaurant Association of Ireland. Adrian, good morning.
Good morning.
Adrian, a lot of focus in the press at the weekend about the fact that the chef Dylan McGrath announced the closure of two of his established Dublin restaurants, saying it was simply not sustainable to keep them open. Now, that attracted a lot of attention. It attracted a lot of column inches. Your argument would be that this has been happening right across the country for a long time, but perhaps not been talked about.
Well, prior to that announcement of Dylan McGrath's two restaurants closing down, we had 577 food-led businesses close since the 1st of September last year, which was when the VAT rate was increased by the government. So to be very clear about this, the government policies are contributing to a broken restaurant industry in Ireland. And when you have had an increase in minimum wage of 12.4%, extra sick days, pension auto-enrollment coming down the tracks, energy increases, and then a VAT rate on top of that from 9 to 13.5%. It's very, very difficult to make margin in any food-led business at the moment. Any of your listeners who have a coffee shop or a small restaurant in Donegal or the Northwest, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about now is in terms of the margins before September last year. You would have got between 5 and 10%. Probably a margin on your business. Now you're between 1 and 5, and a lot of these businesses are in the 1% or the -1%, which means they're just busy fools and they're going to close their doors.
You had made the argument to Minister Michael McGrath and Minister Pascal Donoghue before him when he was in the finance portfolio that 9% VAT rate was crucial for the industry. The ministers and Minister O'Donoghue in particular argued back that as far as the government was concerned, the 9% rate was a temporary measure that was always going to revert back to the 13.5%. When it finally did revert back to the 13.5%, the minister said all the evidence that he had was that was the correct rate at which to pitch it. Do you believe the minister got it badly wrong?
I think the government got it badly wrong in terms of food-led businesses. So the VAT rate at the moment is for food and accommodation, and the entire hospitality industry, including the accommodation sector, are quite happy to see a split in the VAT rate between, what we would say, a decoupling in the VAT rate between accommodation and food. Because food-led businesses are labour-intensive, and what we've seen is the increase in labour costs, while that has increased by, on average, about 10% across the board. The other government policies, like the VAT rate, is having a devastating effect on smaller food-led businesses. And our ask from the government now is to restore the 9% for food-led businesses and make them a viable option into the future. Otherwise, these closure rates will continue and continue and continue. We have businesses that have, you know, warehouse tax accumulated. You have businesses that are trying to pay the taxman every two months. The cash flow isn't there. And it has been a very flat tourism season to date. And consumer spend, we're in a cost of living crisis. When our consumers are seeming to be pulling back in their spend, something has to give, and these businesses are closing down. And we saw in June, for the first time in a long time, the reduction in the number of people working in our industry. And June should be the height of the tourism season. We saw a reduction of 1,800 people in the accommodation and food-led services sector. And that's a key indicator that everything isn't rosy in our industry.
You were talking about the potential decoupling of accommodation and restaurants. Now, the 9% rate was traditionally described as hotels, restaurants and the hospitality sector. Now, I know certainly in this part of the world, the local Irish Hotel Federation reps have been arguing strenuously that 9% is important for hotels as well. So I think I'm not sure they'd be too happy if hotels were excluded and hotels remained at 13.5 while restaurants or food businesses as standalones went back down to the 9.
Well, I think, you know, we have to be clear on this, that I think across the board, the vast majority of the hospitality industry are at one that accommodation seems to be doing okay. That's for them to talk about. But it's hugely challenging now if you're serving food or teas and coffees or whatever, and if you're a coffee shop. And that VAT rate is having a detrimental effect in our industry. You know, I don't think you'll find a hotel that has closed down, but you will find 577 coffee shops, restaurants, pubs that are serving food having closed down since September of last year.
Are you getting any indication from Minister McGrath that he's willing to re-examine this in the next budget?
Well, we have a new minister in charge now in finance, with Minister Jack Chambers.
Of course, beg your pardon, I should remember that. Yeah, sorry,
going as commissioner. But what we do know is that we've met with the backbenchers in both the government parties, and they're very, very much supportive of the 9% VAT rate for food. What we now need to do is make sure that the government parties' backbenchers' voices are listened to. And that they're hearing, you know, their constituents are saying to them very clearly, there's something wrong here. So we need to get the Department of Finance and the two key ministers in that, Mr. Pascal Donohoe and Mr. Jack Chambers, to agree something needs to happen in terms of VAT for food-led businesses. They keep saying that it costs 570 million to the Exchequer if they don't increase it. What we've seen since 2018 is that we're contributing a lot more than the 570 million in terms of tax receipts has increased, even before the increase in the VAT from 9% to 13.5%.
Adrian Cummins, Restaurant Association of Ireland, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. We'll be keeping a close eye on this one, and it's an issue we have obviously discussed before as well. And that is the 9 till noon show for this Monday morning. I'm back with you again tomorrow. John Breslin is coming up. He'll be all around the Northwest as ever. And I just want to say thank you to Shannon for all her help. Thank you to Caroline for her help and for her production and for looking after me as she always does. Also, a very special thank you to all our contributors. Most importantly, thank you to you for listening and for making this show what it is. As I say, John's up next. But for myself, Donal Kavanagh, have a very good day.